For January, all throughout the month of January, we focus kind of on our vision for church ministry and how we hope that makes a difference in your life. So the very first Sunday, we talked about how we want to have an encounter with the Lord that will mark us and shape us, and that we want to then be formed to have our lives look more like Christ. And then we want to join in the mission of God to be God's hands and feet, his ambassadors in the world. And then last Sunday, as we celebrated our 20th anniversary as a church, we looked at the passage that gave us our name, Matthew 9:35-38. And we looked at how the harvest of our world is plentiful. God is drawing people to himself. And what God needs is workers. And so the harvest is plentiful, but we desire to be workers. And we're asking for God to help equip us also to become those kinds of workers. So that was January. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to start a 12-week study in the book of Exodus that will take us all the way into May. And I'm really looking forward to this. So we have 2 weeks between what we were doing and what we're going to be doing. And I was kind of like, what should we do for 2 weeks? And I thought, you know what? I think we should spend time looking at one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament, 1 Kings 18 and 19, a really amazing story about Elijah and Ahab and all sorts of things. And because it's such a powerful, impactful story, I started to kind of ask myself as I was studying it this week, what is it about this story that makes it so powerful? And as I was asking myself that question, I did like kind of a deep dive into what's called narrative structure, the elements of a story. And when you really study the elements of a story and kind of pare back from the specifics of an individual story, you start to see that all movies and all stories are essentially the same. The Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia and Star Wars and Home Alone are all essentially telling the same story in a weird way. So you could break down a story into a variety of ways. The way that I'm going to do it today is into 5 parts. The first part of a story is setting the scene. It's the introduction where you meet the people and the place of the movie or the story and the circumstance that they find themselves in. And then the next part is the inciting incident. It's when we are introduced to the main character and what really motivates them to seek after whatever it is that they're desiring. And then after that comes the crisis. And in most movies, there's like 3 or 4 or 5 different crises that happen in a movie. It's the point of the story where you think, uh-oh, they're not going to be able to do it. And then you think, oh, maybe, they can't. Oh, maybe they, it's the back and forth over and over and over, all the way to the climax of the story. And this is when the main character eventually succeeds in what it is that they're seeking. And then the last part, the 5th part, is the resolution, where we tie up all the loose ends of the story. And so those are the main sections, but then you can see how we could use those main sections to tell different kinds of stories. And within narrative structure, there's even like formats for different kinds of stories, like the rags to riches story. This would be like the story of Cinderella. It follows somebody from poor and poverty and obscurity to wealth and success and notoriety. And then there's the quest story. This would be like Lord of the Rings, or for the Disney fans, Finding Nemo. It would be the story that embarks on this seemingly impossible mission. There's no way anybody could succeed under these circumstances, and they find success despite the many difficulties along the way. Then another story type is the voyage and return story. This would be like Chronicles of Narnia, entering through the closet of coats, or Home Alone 2, as Kevin goes to New York City. And they go on, the main character goes on to this journey into a foreign place and eventually succeeds in victory, and they become a different kind of character as they return home. And then the last part, or last example of a story type that I would highlight, is called Overcoming the Monster. It's the story of an underdog who takes on some sort of monstrous evil and eventually overcomes and wins. Good wins. This would be like the story of Jaws or Jurassic Park or the Rocky series of boxing movies. It would be the Bible story of David and Goliath. And overcoming the monster is our story that we're going to look at today in 1 Kings 18. So what I'd like you to do, if you have a Bible or you like following along on your phone, is I want you to turn to 1 Kings 18. We're starting in verse 17 of 1 Kings 18. And what I want you to do is just kind of set it on your lap. Because for the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to look at the story and then talk about it and then look at it again and then talk about it. We're going to look at 30 verses, but we're not going to read them all at once because I didn't want to put you all to sleep at once, and I thought it might just be a little too much all in one instance. So we're going to take it in small sections, and we're going to use story structure to help us frame this story, to help it hopefully be a little bit more understandable. And so the first thing that we have to do, the first element of a story, is to set the scene. We got to talk about the people and the place and the circumstance that we find ourselves in 1 Kings 18. And the background of this story is that there's a prophet named Elijah who's had kind of a confrontational relationship with a king named Ahab. And the nation of Israel is under judgment because God thinks of Ahab as a very evil, ungodly person. Ahab was the king of Israel for 22 years. And he is written about in the Bible as being the most evil king in the history of the nation of Israel, spanning thousands of years. He is the most evil king. And his wife's named Jezebel, and she has a reputation on her own, and we'll learn more about her next week in 1 Kings 19. But the reason why God is frustrated with the nation of Israel is because Ahab has turned the people away from God toward Baal. They've been worshiping Baal as a nation. And because of this, God announced a 3.5-year drought that Elijah told Ahab about in 1 Kings 17, just a chapter earlier. Well, the reason God wanted there to be a drought was to display his power, because Baal was thought to be the god of the sky. He was the god of the weather. He was the one that provided sunshine and rain. He was thought to be the god of fertility that brought life because of the sun and the rain that he could bring. And so by not allowing it to rain, God is showing how his power overpowers what they think that Baal does. So the kind of the overarching question that we'll have kind of all throughout this story is, who is really in control? Who is really in? Is it Ahab's God, Baal? Or is it Elijah's God, the God of the Bible, the God of the nation of Israel, the maker of heaven and earth? So 3.5 years before the part that we're going to be reading, Elijah announced to Ahab that a drought was coming. And so for 3.5 years, Elijah has been hated by Ahab. In fact, Ahab sent messengers out to foreign countries near there looking for Elijah so that he could bring him back and kill him, because he hated him. And all of the nation of Israel hated Ahab as well, because the drought they were facing, they blamed Ahab for, not God. They didn't blame themselves. They didn't blame God. They blamed Elijah. And so Elijah is Israel's most wanted man. They hate him. They want to kill him. And so this is where we find ourselves. This is the scene that we're about to encounter, which is the inciting incident. And it's going to read like this inciting incident is between Elijah and Ahab. But really, the conflict exists between Baal and God, the God of Elijah and the God of Ahab. And so that's where we pick up the story. 1 Kings 18 Verse 17. When he, this is Ahab talking to Elijah, when he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. This is the first part of the story, really the inciting incident. And it is at the end of these 3.5 years after Elijah had declared the drought, now this confrontation is taking place. But 3.5 years that Elijah spent in hiding away from everyone in Israel because he was hated and they all wanted him dead. And those 3.5 years, I think, were hugely pivotal in Elijah's life. He spent 3.5 years in private training and testing, and it's only now that his public ministry is going to begin as he spends time being the Lord's voice to the nation of Israel. And this kind of idea of private training and testing leading to public ministry is something that comes up a lot within the Bible. A great example of this would be Jesus, whose public ministry began when he was 30 years old. Now, he had spent time teaching in the temple when he was younger, but there's very little written about the life of Jesus up until the point of his public ministry when he was 30 years old. Another example of this would be Moses, who was raised in notoriety in Egypt and then left and eventually became a shepherd for 40 years. For 40 years, he hardly talked to anybody during the day. His job was to deal with sheep all by himself. 40 years, and that training led him to become the leader of the nation of Israel. And so we see this theme coming out in Elijah's life as well, the importance of private ministry leading to public ministry. True faith begins within. It starts there, and only then does it move outward. Now, there are obviously aspects to living the Christian life that are public in nature. Sharing your faith, evangelism, serving others, leadership that some of us at times are called to. All of those are very public ways of living out our faith. But at times, these outward expressions of our faith can become our focal point. The thing that we think embodies what it means to follow Jesus is doing those things, but it's only being with Jesus that allows us to actually helpfully lead in a way that is public in nature. And so I think Elijah is a great example of this for us. Your inner devotion to Jesus must be the guide of your outward expressions. And too often, we get it the other way around. We think, let's pursue the outward thing, and then we'll ask Jesus for help. But it really needs to be the other way around, where the inward work of Christ allows us and motivates us to live it out in a public way. Well, let's continue on. Verse 21. We continue with this inciting incident. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, the God who answers by fire. He is God." And so essentially, what Elijah is calling for here is a showdown, a duel. You create a sacrifice, ask your God to create fire for it. I'll create a sacrifice, I'll ask my God to create fire for it. Whosoever God sets fire to it, he wins. And the people say, end of verse 24, "What you say is good." So they go along with it. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So they took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon, probably 4 or 5 hours. Baal, answer us, they shouted, but there was no response. No one answered, and they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is God. Perhaps he is deep in thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time of the evening for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. There's one word in that passage that I just read from verses 21 through 29. One word that's used two times. It's translated differently, but it's one word in the original Hebrew language that is used in verse 21. It's describing Israel as wavering in their devotion. And then in verse 26, it's translated as the prophets dancing around the altar. And I think probably the best translation is the ESV translation of this word, which describes both of those things as limping. They were limping between two options, and the prophets were limping around the altar, trying to get Baal to provide the fire. And the one word, this Hebrew word, is Pasach, which could literally be translated as Passover, jump, like jump between two things. It gives us this picture of a bird hopping between branches. That's what it's describing. In verse 21, this hopping between branches shows Israel's lack of loyalty to God. They're wavering between Baal and God in their devotion. And then in verse 26, it shows their desperation, the desperation of the prophets as they dance and limp and hop around the altar, trying to get Baal to answer and respond. And I think that actually that kind of picture is a perfect description of what is taking place with the people. And it gives us a picture of what happens to our lives when we do the same. If you try to live your life and get your meaning and your worth and your satisfaction through anything but God, you will limp through life. That's the picture that's given us. Now, the world might look at it and say, well, that looks like a dance. And it might look really good on the outside, but deep within, where God can see, he will see it as a limp. And we can think about that in our own lives as well, our own idolatry, as we turn to a variety of things like birds hopping on branches. Idolatry is just a helpful way to describe this would be anything that we attach our desires, our expectations, our affections, our devotion, or dependence on other than God. That's an idol. We are, like the nation of Israel, hopping between branches, turning to a variety of things that are really false loves, false hopes, false prophets, false masters. And God is responding to the nation of Israel that is reflective of that, turning to all sorts of things instead of him. And the confrontation that's taking place on Mount Carmel is God's opportunity to show them who God really is. Not the ones that they turn to, but that he alone. And so the terms of the duel are very simple. There's 450 prophets of Baal there to prepare a sacrifice and to call on their God to start the fire for the sacrifice. Elijah, all by himself, one prophet of God, prepares the sacrifice, calls on God to start the fire for the sacrifice. Whoever starts the fire first wins. And for hours, the prophets of Baal are calling on God to the point that it even becomes a joke to Elijah. He starts taunting them. Maybe you need to yell a little louder. Maybe your God is sleeping or traveling or unaware of what's actually happening. And it's a joke to him, right? Because he knows the outcome of what's going to happen. And it says at the end there, the summary of this is there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. And so it seems at this point of the story, like victory is just set up on a tee for God to just blast it away. This is perfectly set up for God. Victory is his. But what makes this story, I think, so powerful and impactful is that's actually when the crisis of the story happens. And the crisis is that the odds are stacked against God. So let's continue in it, in the story, verse 30, and read about the crisis. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. He arranged the wood and cut the bull into pieces and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it a third time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench. So to summarize this section, what Elijah has basically done is given Baal and the Baal prophets home court advantage. And what I mean by that is not just the part that we read, but all throughout this story. We see this, for instance, in the place of this duel and showdown happening on Mount Carmel. Archaeology shows us through history that both the Romans and the Assyrians were at times dabbling in worshiping Baal, and that they did so on Mount Carmel. There's inscriptions written about Mount Carmel being the sanctuary of Baal, and that Mount Carmel was the mount of worship for worshiping Baal. And so if there was any place that the Baal prophets would want to have this showdown, it would be on Mount Carmel. This is Baal's territory. And not only was it his territory, but also the prophets outnumbered Elijah 450-1. So there was an advantage of people, a number advantage. And then Elijah let the Baal prophets go first, a position advantage. If they would have been able to start their fire first, the competition would have been over and they would have won. And Elijah let them go first. And then the last advantage we see here is the problem that's introduced. It's the advantage of water. After they were unable to get their fire lit, Elijah says, after he prepares his sacrifice, "Bring 4 large jugs of water and pour it all over the sacrifice. Now do it again. Now do it again. 12 large jugs of water, drenching the sacrifice, the wood, even filling the trench around the altar with water." And the reason why Elijah did this is to say it is not humanly possible to light this fire. It's impossible. You can't do it. It's too wet. Because he wanted to prove to all of them that the only way that this could happen is through supernatural act of God. It's the only way, because nobody else could light this fire. And what we see here, the principle at work of why Elijah is doing this, God loves the odds stacked against him just before he wins. That's the principle at work. God loves to be at a disadvantage because then he gets to display his power and his glory all the more when he wins. Think about Joseph in the prison, overlooked, and eventually rises to be the second most powerful man in Egypt. Think about Gideon and the 300 men who defeat the Midian armies. 300 versus 132,000. Think about Daniel in the lion's den and his friends in the fiery furnace, thought for sure to be dead, and God delivered. Think about Jesus on the cross, laid for dead in a tomb for 3 days, and then God resurrected him from the dead. God does his best work when the odds are stacked against him, and it seems like victory is an impossibility. Well, let's go to the climax. Now that the sacrifice has been drenched, let's see what happens. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are the God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Then Elijah commanded them, Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away. They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. What this is, the climax of the story, is the Lord's victory. And just to remove any doubt about it, is God's fire was sent in a way that Baal's lightning could not do. What I mean by that is, look at the description of this. The fire God sent down consumed not just the bull offering, but also the wood and the dust and the water in the trench. And it even describes that the fire consumed the stones. The stones meaning an inflammable object, something that cannot be lit on fire, was by God lit on fire. And there are other times in the Bible when we see the fire of God sent by the Lord. In Genesis 15, it says that God appeared as a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between the pieces of a sacrifice with him in Abraham. In the book of Exodus, there's a number of times Moses sees a burning bush, the fire of the Lord. Yahweh descends on Sinai in fire, and then the pillar of fire guides the people as they wander in the wilderness. In 2 Kings 2, just a few chapters after the one that we're reading, the fire of God consumes 50 soldiers as they try and arrest and take captive Elijah. In 2 Thessalonians, it describes the second coming of Christ as him returning in a blazing fire. In all of these things, there's a variety of ways in which the fire of the Lord is displayed, but there is one purpose, one unifying purpose, and that is this: God's fire is a provision for his people. In all of those instances, it's a provision for his people. In other words, it's a form of his love. And isn't it amazing that our God, who could display all of his immense power through fire, actually does it as a way to show his love? He shows all of his might and his strength as a form of love. Now go back to the beginning. The question that I asked that's kind of overarching this whole story is, who is in control? Well, here at the climax of the story, as God sends down fire, it's very clear that the maker of heaven and earth, the God of Elijah, is the one in control. He is the God, and it causes the people to turn to him. They recognize him for who he is, and they respond by saying, The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. The fire of the Lord led them to acknowledge God for who he is and then to surrender themselves to him. In this, we see the principle that seeing God for who he truly is ignites the flame of devotion. It stirs us up to want to surrender ourselves to him when we see God for who he truly is. Now, think about our lack of devotion. Why do we often struggle with devotion? Well, I think we're often like the nation of Israel. We're distracted. We want to follow the Lord, but we got a lot of other things going on too. We are like literally the bird branching, jumping, hopping from branch to branch, moving along, because we have so many things in our lives that we think are worthy of our attention and our devotion. And so we jump around from thing to thing. And because of that, we struggle to see God for who he really is, because we're always distracted by something else. And because we don't see him, We don't surrender to him. We're like that branch. Now think about Elijah. His goal was not just for God to display his power, but for the people to surrender to him, to recognize God for who he really is, and to devote themselves to him. He wanted them to move away from their distracted ways of living to instead devote themselves to God. I think of it like this. Oftentimes, I think the way that we pursue relationship with God is kind of how we view self-care in our society. What I mean by that is we want God and we want to devote ourselves to God as long as it's good for us. As long as it helps us build up our own self-satisfaction and helps us feel better about our lives, like, yeah, we'll seek God, but we got a few other things that help us feel good about ourselves too. So he's just one of the options that we could choose from. And so we come to church and we pursue faith as just kind of a way of bettering ourselves. We don't really care about the glory of God. We care about the benefit of our own lives. And what this story does is it kind of wipes away any idea that we can just kind of flippantly play around with God. The God who is the maker of heaven and earth, who is in control of everything, wants you, as Psalm 86:11 says, to have an undivided heart. Psalm 86:11, give me an undivided heart. The nation of Israel divided between two options. We, like birds hopping between branches, give me an undivided heart, focused on you. And we only get that if we can see God for who he really is. Well, we have to finish the story now, the resolution, to see how it ends. Verse 41 to the end of the chapter. Elijah said to Ahab, go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain. So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees, probably because he was tired. Go and look toward the sea, he told his servant. And he went up and looked. There's nothing there, he said. Seven times Elijah said, go back. The seventh time the servant reported, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. So Elijah said, go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rain started falling. And Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. And finally, we can say, this is the word of the Lord, our passage for today, the end of our passage for today. We come to the end of the story. The Baal prophets have been defeated. God has displayed his power. Elijah has achieved a monumental victory for the history of the nation of Israel as the people turn back to the Lord. And almost as like the perfect movie-like ending, after 3.5 years of drought that had been declared by God's prophet Elijah, God sends the rain. God sends the rain as a way to kind of wrap it all up. And so what's the point of this story? We looked at 30 verses. We talked about a lot of the backstory. What's the point of this story? I mean, we could have a lot of different opinions. I'm not saying mine's perfect, but I think we see the point of the story in the response of the people of the nation of Israel. The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. I think we see that in their response. God is not a tradition. God is not a symbol. God is not just a story. God is not a main character in a story. The Lord, he is God. He is the fire-breathing, prayer-answering God who longs to be near to you. And all of this display of his power and his majesty and his glory that we read about in 1 Kings 18 was to draw in the people of the nation of Israel to worship him again, to be close to him again. I think of 1 John 3:1. What love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called his children, and that is what you are. God displays his glory because he longs to lavish us with his love. He longs to be near to us. So how do we understand and maybe even apply this story to our own lives? I have just kind of two concluding thoughts that I think help us apply this passage. The first is that even when it seems like the obstacles between us and obedience to God seem insurmountable or impossible, God's strength and his power can carry you through. Even when it seems like I don't know how to move forward in a way that honors God, that seems impossible, God has strength and power to carry you through. So think about the last time that you took on something in your life that felt like it was probably impossible to accomplish. When's the last time that you prayed a prayer that you are quite sure God would never answer because it is impossible? When do we embrace those kinds of steps of bold faith, of sensing God leading in a direction that seems actually impossible to actually accomplish what it is we feel led toward? I had to apply this passage and this reality to myself last night. It was about 9 p.m. I was preparing for this morning, reading through the passage, thinking through everything that I wanted to say, and feeling woefully inadequate. Here is this just amazing passage, and I thought, how on earth can I do justice to this incredible story? I felt inadequate, incapable. I thought, there's got to be somebody better to preach on this passage to the church today. And as I'm having all of those doubts and insecurities and frustrations, I get to this part of my notes and I'm like, oh, maybe that applies to me. And I know all of you often perceive pastors as somehow we have it all together and we're perfect pictures of faith and just follow our example and you'll be great. But the reality is that I struggle with the same things that you struggle with. Doubts, insecurities, inadequacies, those things that you feel are true of you or God leads in a direction and you say, I don't know. I don't think I have what it takes to do that. And so in disobedience, you step back from where God is calling. And what 1 Kings 18 reminds us of is that God is bigger than those things, and he will and can carry you through to them and where he longs to take you, despite how you feel about the possibilities of what you can actually do. He's greater. And so what God wants us to do is to be faithful, trusting people of him, not perfect people. He knows that we struggle and we doubt and we waffle and we hop between all the things, right? God recognizes that in us. He doesn't want us to be perfect. He wants us to just simply say yes and to be open to his work. And so that's the first part that I think really applies to us. And the second part is something that we're going to look at a lot more next week as we jump into 1 Kings 19, because the passage just leads us right in that direction. But as I read this passage, I have to imagine that there are many of you that are like, wow, that's an amazing story. I have never experienced God like that in my life. Or it's been years since God has felt that close and that powerful in my life. If most of us are willing to be honest, there's quite often in our week, in our lifetimes, where God feels distant. Tuesday afternoon is a long ways from Sunday, and whatever high you might experience here of feeling close to the Lord might be gone by then. Where is God when it seems like his fire isn't coming from heaven and he's not answering our prayers? When God feels far away, hidden, or distant? How do we read a passage like 1 Kings 18 and not just feel sad for ourselves that we don't have that experience right now? How do we read it and understand it? Well, I think Jeremiah is a great example for us. He's known as the weeping prophet. He's largely depressed throughout the whole book that he wrote because God has sent him to be his voice to the nation of Israel, and nobody is responding to him. In fact, they all hate him and they turn against him. And it causes Jeremiah to be depressed and frustrated and wondering why God had sent him to do this because it wasn't working. And right in the middle of the book of Jeremiah, God gives him a word of encouragement. And this word of encouragement is actually our memory verse for the month of February. If you got our email this week that highlighted all the February events, down at the very bottom was a memory verse. And I heard some of you complain about how long the Philippians 4:8 memory verse was in January. So this one's short, okay? Jeremiah 29:13. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. God is not far away. God is actually near. And what this verse reminds me of is even the desire to know and draw close to God when he feels distant is a sign that he is actually near. And that as you seek him with all of your heart, it is a promise that you will find him. As you seek him with all of your, as you're devoted to him, an undivided heart, solely focused on him, as you do, you will find him. And so the distance that it might seem like God is far off is actually him drawing near as you sense yourself wanting to be close to him. In the New Testament, within the Gospels, we see Jesus respond to small, simple acts of faith. Not overwhelming mountains of faith. He says, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, it's hard to find a seed smaller than a mustard seed. You can move mountains. He responds to small, simple acts of faith. And so I think the challenge of 1 Kings 18 is to lay aside the distractions, to choose the Lord, and devote ourselves to him. And that when we do, he will carry us far beyond where we thought we could go on our own. And he has amazing possibilities of what it means to follow him and to seek him as we put our trust in him.